accession number 30108, Reel 7.
Trailways, Reel 7.
Okay, so we had turned onto roughly a reciprocal heading going back towards Camilla Creek House. I was in the back on a monkey harness looking for the aircraft. Suddenly he's coming out of the 3 o'clock, very close, and I'm screaming at the boss, turn right, turn right, turn right. Working on the old fighter ground attack evasion tactics to get inside him. So the boss is turning right, I'm going harder, harder, harder. He tells me later he was fixated on not over-torquing the engine, making sure that he was in full control of the aircraft. I was able to say to him, he's released his weapon load, and they were rockets, and he'd fired. We turned on the right for, he was roughly 90 degrees to us. The rockets exploded, meters in front of us. Peat thrown out all over the windscreen. The boss puts the windscreen wipers on. You see, we need to see where we're going. Aircraft overshoots. There's another one coming in immediately from, it might have been almost simultaneously. I'm saying, go right, go right. There's another one latched on in our 7 o'clock, and I'm thinking, if we go right, we're just exposing our tail to this one. And then there's another sense of explosion underneath. In fact, I think I called again. He's firing. Explosion under the tail boom. Lifts up the aircraft, it sort of pitches forward, off we go, and going through my mind a number of things, I'm thinking, get back to Camilla Creek House, because that's where some guys from M Flight are. He's got a GPMG. He hit a fighter the other day. He was revered within M Flight, and you know, I just wanted some ground cover to drive these people off, and I think we were probably attacked another time. A millisecond, I thought, what if I pop the doors and jump out? I'll only break my legs. And that's gone. And then you're calling evasion tactics again. Suddenly they're gone. And we're near Camilla Creek House. We touch down. And then you've got to go through the close down procedure. You've got to wait for the rotors to close down and stop. And you're sitting there. It's interminable. The boss is doing the fastest close down in history. Suddenly the engine stops. We pop the doors. We jump out. We run up to find the slit trench. And I can see some smoke in the air. And so I think they've hit one. They've hit a Bukhara. And someone said, no, that's the other scout. So I think, oh, shit. Then we run back down to the aircraft, flash it up again, and think, we've got to find the source of the smoke. Well, when we get there, another Gazelle has beaten us to it, and there's two air crewmen have leapt out. Billy Belcher's on the ground, and they're already patching him up. So I jump out to the scout. The Gazelle is still on the ground. Nick Pounds, the captain, is the pilot of that one, Captain Nick Pounds. And they've got Billy. They're using bits of aircraft to splint him, wrapping his legs up. They've whacked him with some more morphine. And still noise, you know, there's two sets of rotor blades going. The burning wreckage of the scout. So I set off to find Dick Nunn. And but he's in there. Okay, so Dick Nunn, he's still in the cab. He's still in his seat, still upright. No way that he can be alive. So I shout to the other air crewman, he's dead. He's dead. And probably too loud for them, because I remember JC shouted, okay, we've got that, we heard you. So as quick as we can, we get Billy into the back of the scout and lay him out on the back. I get in the front and I'm constantly monitoring, looking back, as we need to get him back to Ajax Bay as quickly as possible. There's nothing we can do for the other guy. Now, I know that there's a difference of opinion here, because Jeff Nibbler thinks I was in the back with Billy. And Billy's recollection is that he was in the back on his own. And I concur with that, because I can recall turning around, looking at him. He's calm, he's rational, he's staring up at the ceiling or the roof of the cab, and he knows that there's nothing he can do now. And then we get back up over Sussex Mountains and hand him over. same as any other casualty. And then we've got to go back. And then we see him that night. So we've handed him back, and we were not to see Bill until that night when some of the aircrew went across and visited him, by which time his leg's been amputated and burnt in an oil drum out the back of the refrigeration plant. His kit has destroyed, and he's on a dusty floor propped up in some mattress cot. And I think he's worrying about losing part of his pipe or something like that, you know, trying to be jovial. However, the next morning, we've got to go back and pick Dick Nunn up. And so, three of us flew back down, a couple of body bags. And a couple of body bags, and pick him up, light as a feather. He's actually fallen out of the airframe, barely recognizable as a human form, really. I said, no, he's recognizable as a human form, but featureless from the fire. And take him back.
Had he been killed, actually, in the first part of the Polaris pass through, though? Had he been killed?
I think, no, because the first pass, as far as I'm aware, hit belt, rounds came in through the back of the cab, probably 20 mil, and destroyed the lower part of Bill's right leg. He articulated that to the pilot, who had the wherewithal to say, grab the first aid pack. There was then another pass in which we believe Dick Nunn was killed with 7.62. The same burst hit Bill in his left leg. The aircraft impacted, bounced, touched again, spun around, and the centrifuge, the first time it bounced or the second time it bounced, the flexion of the airframe, probably the doors popped off, as it spun around, the centrifugal force threw Bill out. We think head first, because he was laying on the back seat, but his monkey harness detached from the decking, and he was therefore thrown clear of the wreckage. He then bum-shuffled away from the aircraft, which I've since recently seen a photograph of, not recognizable as an aircraft at all, just totally incinerated. And Bill gave himself his first jab of morphine. The Gazelle came in, and at that point, not long after, minutes after, we came in on the scout and picked him up.
You mentioned when the attack had been made on your helicopter that they just disappeared. Was there a stage where they just broke off the attack from you?
Well, as we got closer to Camilla Creek House, they felt more vulnerable through ground fire. Whether they'd run out of ammunition, I really don't know, but it stopped as suddenly as it began. Everything happens in sort of, you think a lot, but probably in a very short space of time, like the jumping out. The other thought when the second aircraft was coming in was, merely, I'm going to die.
Does time concertina in now, sort of? Does it kind of squash together or expand slightly?
I think it all happens very quickly, but you see, your brain puts in a huge amount of thought in that short space of time. And that's why it was less emotional than I am now. I'm going to die. Acceptance.
Was that a very clear thought in your mind?
Totally. But it wasn't. There was no fear with it. It was a fact, matter of fact. Any fear is that waiting for the sun to come up.
So more
to start again.
So more waiting and preparation gives you fear, waiting
absolutely
for something to happen, rather than when you're actually engaged in it.
And you know that you've got to get up. You know you've got to do it. Because it's a job.
After that situation had occurred, were you actively engaged almost right away back into operations?
Absolutely. You know, it just carried on. But once it starts, once you get in the aircraft, not a problem.
Again, it's not the concentration. Again, you have to focus on what you're doing at that time.
Yeah.
Was that a help at the time, do you think, that you were able to get moving, get organised?
I suppose. You know that there is no alternative. You have to get up, strap in, go and do the job that you've been tasked, and finish the day.
What had happened at that stage? Were you aware of what had happened at Goose Green? Was the action over?
No. I mean, we continued. After that, taking Bill back, we actually continued with more Kazovacs for the rest of that day. I mean, we were there until last light, and I recall being at Camilla Creek House, a company of 40 commando had moved forward, and a young Marine could see he could see the effect. Yeah, I mean, the next day they surrendered those settlements anyway. If they hadn't, then the alternative was only more of the same. You're not in a position to say, I don't want to go to work today.
So you have to continue on doing the same task again and again and again. Yep. Really in that role. Was it hard, obviously, with you being quite a small, close-knit unit as well? Because you knew everybody, didn't you?
And only later, I mean, I've looked at the statistics in percentage terms, and we all knew anyway that aircrew was a dangerous existence because we had so many friends who'd been killed in mere accidents without all these additions thrown in. But when we looked at the how many percentage had been killed and injured, and later, for better or worse, how many awards the squadron got. No compensation, but I think we got recognition for that, for what we did.
You say that you had to carry on, but what was the next stage after the operations at Goose Green? What were you involved in there?
Oh, a lot of liaison, because we were moving forward then. Of course, we were moving out of Ajax Bay. And in coming out of that area and moving on to Teal Inlet, we were in open territory again. So every time we flew, it was always air attack. When we got into Goose Green and Numero Uno was small arms from the ground, that was never to be again. Every time we flew after that, we were going to be shot down by aircraft. That's all we thought.
So the threat had changed.
Absolutely.
In your own
mind. In my mind, and in my boss's mind as well, I guess. Those of us who had been, and maybe it hadn't in those who hadn't been attacked by aircraft, maybe they were still living with a picture of what had last happened to them. But for us, and senior officers we flew, I mean, they were always extremely aware of that long leg from San Carlos Water round to Teal Inlet, Estancia House, whatever.
You say senior officers, who were you flying?
Oh, we were flying brigade commander, regular passenger, and I can't recall any COs. You know, there's some people stick in your mind, obviously, and SAS guys.
Mm-hmm. Were they insertions that you were doing?
I don't know, we did a couple of exfiltrations as well, where they needed to get out, fairly quickly. So,
how many kind of missions would you be flying a day, really? You'd be doing it at that kind of duration of time.
Yeah, we didn't. We didn't break it down by mission. My logbook will show how many hours in that day, and the notebook that I used to record before carefully and neatly transposing it in my logbook will record only a total number of hours. Because you couldn't define the tasks as a specific task. What started out as, maybe a straightforward liaison trip suddenly turned into something else. You know, ammunition resupply turned into moving someone from A to B, or turned into a CASAVAC.
So you couldn't really say what you'd be doing from one session
to the next, no. We would perhaps be given to a unit, and then that unit would control us as part of their plan.
And that would be what you would be tasked for at that period of time.
Yes,
so you could have
a
numerous task within that?
Yes, yeah. You see, we couldn't develop our plan because we were mostly subjected to other people's plan. And that's fine. You know, we were a tool for them to use often.
So you were acting more as a reactive thing rather than proactive in any form, were you?
Yes.
You would do what was requested of them at that
because,
time.
Yeah, because they would have their objective and probably within a given time frame, work out what equipment they needed, and they'd be given some tools, never enough tools. And if we were one of those tools, they would use us to the best of the ability that they... within the realms of their own experience, which is why it was so important that our senior pilot was at Goose Green, because he could say, no, you don't, you're wasting this tool. You need to use it in another way. It's not designed for that.
Did you find your workload had increased, obviously, with the sinking of the Atlantic conveyor, and you doing tasks that you might not have thought you might have been performing?
Yeah, I mean, I did get a bit miffed that... a large aircraft, a Sea King, would come in and, I think the figures were something like underslung load, 5,000 pounds, and drop it at an echelon. Couldn't possibly go any further forward because it's expensive asset, in their view. We would say, hang on a minute, that's 10 trips for us to take it forward. Why don't you just take it forward in one trip? And by the law of averages, you will survive. And I can remember our senior pilot remonstrating with another group, which to pick up some casualties would have needed 4 scouts instead of 1 big helicopter. And they sit over the air, live, saying, what makes 4 scouts and their footprint on the ground any less attractive than 1 Sea King?
So there was still that equation there that people were saying that this is a too valuable an asset to lose, but we can use these...
Yeah, but they were making that decision arbitrarily. And I might be treading on toes here, but, you know, we had a naval flight commander in a Gazelle flight who said to another helicopter pilot, a naval asset, there isn't a problem, follow me. Because there was a reluctance to go and do this particular task.
Did they understand the lie of the land as much as
no.
you had?
No, certainly not. Well, the jungly squadrons, 845 and 846, are pretty well versed in commando tactics, infantry tactics. The anti-submarine guys, not clear. We actually saw one at high level blissfully heading off towards Stanley one day, and thought someone about to call him back. Because that's the beauty of army aviation, if the guys have had experience as infantiers, I think.
But with yourselves, obviously, you have that low-level, hugging-the-ground kind of experience, don't you, within an environment like that. Does that come as second nature to you guys, which it wouldn't?
No, it wouldn't, of course, because they have a low-level, over-the-sea hover for 6 hours. Isn't quite the same as... And I can see the difficulty, but the only way, when I say I get on my high horse about some aspects of it, it's only that, you know, that one person should be more important than another, and I wonder, is it the asset or the person who are they making that decision on behalf of the £1 million, £10 million thing wrapped around them, or are they making it on because of Joe Bloggs inside. Wrong.
How did it progress? You mentioned some of the duties that you were doing as everything started to advance. I take it there wasn't, although there was a threat from the air, it didn't manifest itself in quite the same way again. With
no, not probably not for anyone in the air squadron after that. I think once the maybe the Argentinian Air Force pulled stumps, then we had air superiority. And of course, Harriers became more obvious. As I said, Goose Green, they came in at 7 o'clock that evening, and maybe the combat air patrol visibility kept them down. But all I can say is that moving around the islands at low level, at whatever speed, post 28th of May, huge sense of vulnerability. And the old cocoon, womb-type existence, sense of security, false security, dissipated.
Were there any incidents that occurred during that advance towards Stanley that you were involved in? Anything that's sticking in
your mind? One particular incident sticks in my mind. We'd had a rebroadcast station lifted forward, I think it was in a Land Rover, underslung by a support helicopter, who put them on a forward slope. And the guys in there had watched an artillery shell land and thought, oh, our guys, that's a bit short, they want to increase their range. Then another one landed a bit closer. Then they suddenly realised it was incoming rather than outgoing. So they had to get out of there pretty quick. And we had a call to pick them up at night from such and such a grid reference. And so off we flashed and picked these guys up. And I was talking to one of them only yesterday. Actually, I didn't bring this subject up for some reason. I probably forgot. Anyway, they got them back, and we did the call back to base that we'd picked them up, and they're all fine. And a voice chirped up from the back, because we put the headsets on them. They were on the intercom. Chirped up from the back, and, oh, excuse me, Sarge, he said, I'm wounded. I've got a load of shrapnel in my legs. Well, he'd been totally uncomplaining, and they were rock fragments. But the fragments had been travelling with sufficient velocity to knock the magazine off his SLR and dent the housing. So he was fairly well peppered on the back of his legs. And this is a guy I later heard refused to be casevac'd to the hospital ship because it meant he couldn't partake in any future action.
You'd move these guys back. Was the Land Rover abandoned there, or was that?
Well, apparently it was abandoned with too much kit in it, and the cry was, go back and burn the Land Rover. I'm not sure what happened to it, but yeah, there was, because they'd gone forward as a rebroadcast station, I mean, I think they left it hurriedly, and perhaps a book which should have been in their pocket was still in there. Could have compromised, but then they changed to a plan B, wouldn't they?
How suited would you say the Scout was for the operations that you were doing?
How
suited was it as a helicopter for the types of tasks that you were involved in?
Well, it was pre-Lynx days. But then again, had we had Lynx, who knows what the technical problems would have been. At least with the Scout, he was first generation fine. But it kept going and going and going. We had chewing gum around the windscreens to keep the water out. Our Scout, I think, flew with a red light on the panel, and the Remy checked. I think it was an inverter or something, I can't remember exactly. But the Remy checked it out and said, that's okay, that's acceptable under these conditions. But I can remember picking up a senior officer who very quickly said, there's a red light on the panel, and the boss said, no, it's okay, we've sorted that out.
I imagine it must have been quite something when you had senior officers in there with you, because you're obviously doing these tasks day in, day out.
Yeah.
To actually carry somebody who is in that situation and thinks, oh my God, I'm in a helicopter.
Well, and the other thing, of course, is they have more knowledge of the technical capabilities of some weapon systems than we have, perhaps. Because when we come round into the anchorage and weapon systems lock onto you as soon as you come around the headland, And the commander's then saying, bloody sunsets are pooing themselves again. Different words used.
Was there ever the occasion that you might be worried by friendly fire or accidental fire. Was that ever a thought?
No, I mean, it existed. And I've already mentioned taking off from a deck when a GPMG is flying above us. No. I think, again, you have to, in your mind, think what's the greatest threat. And somewhere down the order of threats is that one. But if you thought of all of them and put on top of it how fragile these aircraft are, and how little leads and pipes with fuel and lubricating oils, there's so much else to go wrong. I mean, you really wouldn't get out of your sleeping bag in the morning. Be far too much to contemplate.
As the campaign moved forward, were you getting aware, obviously you're aware of the situation and that you're on the winning side as such. How are you feeling as you're getting towards Stanley?
No better, to be honest. I remember the last aircrew briefing when all the flights came together, looking around thinking, if there's a briefing tomorrow night, not every face will be here. Actually, every face was there, did survive. But black humour had, you know, supplanted some elements of grief. The night after Goose Green, we were eating 10-man composite rations because all the 24-hour rations were going to the Grevs. So we were sharing out 10-man ration packs between 10 blokes. So on the night of the 27th, a guy only liked the tin sausages. So we gave him the tin sausages. No one ate a jar of margarine, but he had first call on the sausages. And then he was killed on the 28th. And on that night, the 28th, someone happened to say, anyone want the sausages? It was a resounding cry of, piss off, I ain't eating the sausages. You know, that's the kiss of death. It's the black spot.
What were the last operations you were flying?
Down there? Oh, right. We took J.J. Moore into Stanley and the Brigadier for the surrender. We flew into the air, the race course at Stanley, and there were still Argentinian aircraft flying around. Painted up white with red crosses on, there were still Argentinian troops all around us with weapons.
What did that feel like, actually? Because obviously you're seeing masses of the enemy, really, which I suppose you'd only seen fleetingly in some
aspects. Yeah, I mean, the scale of it. We can look how many people there are here. Why have they packed up? I actually thought it wasn't really final. We'd stopped too soon. Look at all these people.
Was that a general feeling amongst you and your colleagues?
I don't know.
You know, isn't that an awful lot of people here? And you know, we were.
Sensibly, we should have all thought, "Thank God it's finished. No one else is going to die." There must be other guys like me who felt we haven't really knocked the final nail in here. You know. Nothing you could do, of course, because they surrendered. But maybe they surrendered too early. They certainly had, you know, the manpower, the rations in 20-foot containers down in the town, and unbelievable. And you know, they had the ammunition.
Did you get to see the armoured cars?
No, they were tucked. I think I saw they were tucked away in a street somewhere. They never actually came into play.
So that
all that training came to naught.
What happened once they'd surrendered the Argentinians? What tasks were you involved in there? Was it still much of the same for them?
Very much liaison, flying people about. And, you know, there were some were jollies. Someone wanted to have a go look at Top Marlow House, just to see what was left of it after the action there. But a lot of... I was ill for a while in Stanley. All that time in the field, not a problem, getting to Stanley... and a stomach bug for about four days, I suppose. And a couple of guys got sick. And but the tasking was very much low-key, moving people from A to B, repositioning.